Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, adjuncts, and alumni. The recording you're about to hear is from the 2025 Launches at the Library program. It was recorded on the 29th of April at the La Trobe University Library on unceded Wurundjeri country. Cold-blooded killers, grief-stricken widows, famous artists, independent women with sharp minds and large fortunes, and a cap doffed to Jane Austen's 250th birthday. In today's event, we hear from Dr. Kelly Gardner and Sharmini Kumar, authors of Miss Carolyn Bingley, Private Detective, along with the author of Diving Falling, Dr. Kylie Miramahadi, as we celebrate the publication of these outstanding books, in conversation with Professor Katie Holmes.
Welcome everybody to this Launches at La Trobe event. I'm sitting in for Claire Wright, who has been unexpectedly called up to Arnhem Land for the week. My name is Katie Holmes, and like Claire, I'm a historian. You'll find me in the History Department and Director of the Centre for the Study of the Inland. So the Launches at the Library events are supported or sponsored by the Office of the Vice-Chancellor with the intention of celebrating the new publications and the wonderful writers that we have in our La Trobe community, both our academics, our alumni, our students and staff. So it's a really exciting event. This is the first one for this year. There will be more. All of the past events are available on the podcast that is being curated by Claire Wright in her capacity as the Professor of Public Engagement. They're also there with other La Trobe literary events, including the Writers on Campus series that Kelly was curating for the past 2 years, I think. Is that right? Something like that, or feels longer? and also the last 2 years' worth of the Bendigo Writers Festival, which Claire Wright also curates. So that includes interviews with Christos Stolkus, Helen Gardner, Don Watson, Thomas Keneally, and many, many more literary luminaries. And this event is also being recorded and it will be podcast, so keep that in mind when you're asking your questions. Don't say anything you don't want to be on the record for a long time. Do stick around at the end for refreshments and book sales and author signings. And I also would like to acknowledge that we are meeting, of course, on Wurundjeri land. And to think about what that means in terms of custodianship, but also in terms of creativity and learning and the celebration of the ways in which First Nations communities have nurtured land and also had such an incredibly important and ongoing influence in creativity and cultural richness and depth. So it's now my delight to introduce our three authors, and then Carrie Tiffany is going to take over for me. So we have here Carrie Tiffany, who many of you will know is now a lecturer in English and creative writing here at La Trobe. She's a former park ranger and the author of three acclaimed novels, which if you haven't read her work, I just commend it to you. Every Man's Rules for Scientific Living, Mateship with Birds, which won the inaugural Stella Prize, and most recently Exploded View, which is an incredibly powerful novel. Special thrill for me is introducing also Kylie Miramahadi, who is an adjunct senior researcher in the English and Creative Writing program. Her first novel is Diving Falling, which was published by Scribe last year and has been listed as the best book for 2020, a best book for 2024 by Guardian Australia, The Saturday Paper, The Australian In Review and Good Reading magazine. And Kylie has another hat that she wears as an academic. She's also a historian. I've been a co-author with her, and she's also written on Charles Dickens and much on Jane Austen as well. Kelly Gardner writes historical fiction for readers of all ages, including young adult fiction novels such as Act of Faith and The Sultan's Eyes. Her Austen-inspired crime novel, Miss Carolyn Bingley, which is over there, as is Kylie's book, Miss Carolyn Bingley, Private Detective, is co-authored with Sharmini Kumar and was published just this month, I think that's right. Kelly taught here creative writing for many years and is now an adjunct senior research fellow. And lastly, Sharmini Kumar is a writer, director and producer and the founder of the artistic director of 24 Karat Productions. She's written, directed and produced many performance pieces and short films, but her debut novel, as I've just said, is Miss Caroline Bingley, Private Detective, and co-authored with Kelly, so they're both here. She's an honorary, was an honorary associate at La Trobe University from 2017 to 2019. And when she's not writing and directing, she works as a doctor and teaches medicine in all your spare time. I mean, how amazing, what an amazing lineup. So over to you, Carrie. Thanks.
Just give me a little wave and we've got about 15 minutes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for those lovely introductions, Katie. It's wonderful to be here with these three writers. One of whom I know quite well, and the other two I'm getting to know. But what's the best way of getting to know a writer, of course, is through the text, is through the book. So part of my Easter when I wasn't marking creative nonfiction folios, I was reading these wonderful books. So that was fabulous. So thank you for inviting me to this conversation today. So two quite different books that we're talking about today. So I'm trying to negotiate those kind of differences. But one of the things that occurred to me in reading them was that there's these slightly contrary kind of impulses. They're kind of moving against each other. So Kelly and Sharmini's book takes a Jane Austen character, Caroline Bingley, in the Regency period, kind of out of the drawing room and explodes her into multicultural London. Not something that Austen did. You know, we had fairly close, tight-knit kind of drawing room books, sometimes moving to other places, other counties in London. But that kind of sense of a particular world, particular enclosed world. And Kylie's book, which is a contemporary realist novel set in Melbourne, we've just been talking about where it's been set because we've both been walking similar paths to some of the characters in this book, which is a very lovely thing about a book set locally, that you can become kind of part of its geography and imagination. But it's a very tight-knit book. It feels quite enclosed. It's mainly set in a house, a very special house. It has a very small, very intimate and intense cast of characters. It's a relationship book. So there's this kind of thing that's happening. You've kind of done something oppositional and unexpected with both of these books. So I wanted you perhaps to speak to that first, and particularly whenever I read and I open a book, the big question for me is always, why this, why you? Why this particular, this idea, this making meaning from a story has occurred to you at this time? So, Kel, would you like to head off? And then,
I actually wondered if we could start with Kylie, because yeah. I'd be interested in, you know, you were describing the drawing room book.
Mm.
Are there Austen drawing, you know, that small community? Do you feel like there's an influence there? And did you start from with that consciousness?
I've said this a few times in interviews about the book. When I first started talking about Diving Falling, I was very keen to draw a distinction between the academic me, who read about Austen and Dickens, and the novelist me. The more I thought about it, the more I was asked about it, I realised there was actually some really interesting shared qualities. And I think, as Carrie points out, that is exactly one of them, was that it's Austen often wrote about a small group of interconnected people, and this is the small group. And also, I think there's a certain, I think we can say archness in some of the narration in Diving Falling, and I sense that in Austen as well. So these are connections that I certainly wasn't consciously drawing on that as a model, or in fact I was resisting that idea. But the more I've settled into it, the more I do see those really strong Austen connections. But in terms of you know, why me, why this, I think why me, I feel like I was born to write Layla and to write her in the stage of life that I was in when I wrote her. And it chose me. She chose me. I had it a sense of us spending, as we were talking about, a lot of time during the pandemic walking around the local landscapes around me and the river and the creek landscapes. And I just had a very strong visual image in the initial stirring of the novel of this beautiful brutalist house with sleek modernist lines up against the blue sky and the eucalyptus, which our amazing designer captured so beautifully on the cover, like way after the fact. And the idea of a woman sitting down in that house to write the obituary of her very famous husband, and just the possibilities in that. So that was how it. That's why me and why this, I guess.
Sharmini, you started this, didn't you? So tell us
exactly.
About that.
Started is a well. What happened was, I was running an event called AustinCon, which is a thing that I do. And this was pre-pandemic 2019.
Kylie was there.
I was there at the moment of conception.
That's right. That's right. Kelly was talking about Austin in the diaspora retellings in the diaspora, and
Kylie was.
Sorry.
Kelly was talking about heroines, weren't you?
Characters. Kylie was talking about the diaspora. Yeah. Kelly was talking about heroines and tropes that heroines kind of follow through, the way that we've continued on some of Austin's tropes and ideas for women heroines, you know, the feisty, spunky heroine, the kind of enemies to lovers romance, all this kind of stuff. And Kelly said, she was talking about Caroline Bingley and about the female gentleman kind of archetype. And then she said,
Caroline Bingley would make a great private detective.
And then some smart aleck up the back of the room, yep. That was me, goes, I'm on it. And I went up to her afterwards and said, I was joking, it's fine, I'm not on it. I'm, you know, this is not a thing, I was just stirring, it's yours. But Kelly being very gracious goes, look, I'm not gonna get to it. I've got so many other books I wanna write, I'm all these things, just go ahead and write it. I've never written a novel before, I write mostly plays and screenplays and things like that. So I kind of sweated on it and started outlining, and I have no idea about murder mysteries, none of this. In the meantime, Kel was off in England having fun.
Dot, dot, dot. And then, I went on a Jane Austen, is that what you wanted me to do?
Yeah.
Jane Austen literary pilgrimage. So I went to, I stayed in Winchester, I went out to Chawton to the house and her brother's house and went to Bath, and I'd never been to Bath, and I was walking around all day thinking, I can just imagine Caroline Bingley investigating, like scurrying around, opening doors and things. And why the hell did I say that out loud? And say I didn't, you know, I wouldn't need to worry. But, you know, Sharmini, yes, go write it. Damn it, damn it, damn it. Because in the meantime, I'd regretted my life choices deeply. And then I went to the old Roman baths, which is, you know, why it's called Bath. And there, just being a tourist, was Anna Chancellor, who played Miss Bingley in the BBC series. And so I went, oh, I'm in human. I didn't talk to her or anything. Apparently that was wrong. But I'm too shy. Anyway, I just had my own little epiphany. And so I went back to the Airbnb and messaged Sharmini and said, do you want some help with that? And she went, yeah.
Yeah, I was up to all kinds of things in the denouement. Somebody cut somebody's horse's tendons. Anyway, it was terrible. It was absolutely terrible.
Better be there, don't worry. Yeah.
Oh, I took that out.
There's no animal cruelty.
They are starting to sound a little bit like those Queensland twins. Don't you think? They're starting to sort of talk at the same time a little bit. But anyway, just a comment. Yeah.
You know what I was thinking this morning? Mm. It actually started much earlier because Kylie, in this very building, Kylie organised a Jane Austen seminar.
Yes.
Why was that? Was it the centenary or the bicentenary of the
death?
Oh, okay.
2017, right?
Must have been, yeah.
Yeah.
So upstairs from here, Kylie organised a seminar. Sharmini was there.
Yeah, because Kylie invited me. Yeah. Brought you two together.
Yes, except we didn't actually speak that day. But anyway, but that's what got me thinking about Jane Austen's characters and how they, because she had nothing to do with my research interests, so basically still doesn't, because the things I said at AustinCon I would never get away with in an academic conference. I just made shit up. And but you memorised it, which is good. Brownie points for you. And so this is where it started.
Yeah, so it's actually
your upstairs. Kylie. It's all your fault. Yeah, so that's why.
I need to take credit.
Yeah, well, Kylie's one who kind of inspired me to kind of dig more into Austin.
So we are basically the Queensland triplets.
Yeah. The co-authorship is fascinating to me. You know, I've written a couple of novels. The idea of even showing what I'm writing to anyone else, let alone writing together, is astonishing to me. Like, I feel you two should possibly be running the UN rather than writing novels, that you could do this in a way that you still clearly like each other.
So far.
But what I'm interested in, because, you know, a book is kind of a vision, isn't it? So much of it is in your mind, and then you're trying to kind of make sense of that on the page. How do you think it would be a different book if you had just done it singularly? Like if you'd written it, or Sharmini, aside from the horse butchery, you'd written it. Do you think it would have been a significantly different book? You've made something that has really just come out of both of you somehow.
It would absolutely be different if I did it. Like, I don't have anywhere near the experience writing. Or, yeah.
I mean, yes, it would be, because there are things that came out of our discussions that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So what we did was we sort of did a bit of plotting. So Sharmini had written several chapters and invented some new characters that are not from Austin. So that's where we started, and then we did a bit of plotting together. But things happen when you write, so we always had the space to just say, oh, my God, I just accidentally killed your favourite character, sorry, and negotiate things as you go. But I think if you were just doing it in your own brain, anything might happen. Well, I'm not that much of a plotter normally, depends what on the project, so anything might happen. So it was about creating a sort of structure where you could take us a few steps forward, or take the characters a few steps forward, but still allow stuff to happen. So I think, yeah, it would be completely different.
Well, Kylie, I wanted to ask you, because I know that you were one of the first readers of the novel, which is also a lovely association, and that you read it in very early draft, and that you're an Austin expert. So there's many examples of writers creating or taking on a character of another novelist and kind of springing them into their own text or a new text. I'm thinking of Coetzee's Foe. I'm thinking of Jones's Mr. Pip. Last year I read Everett's James, based on the Mark Twain, which is very interesting. I'm wondering if you felt kind of trepidatious or protective at all about this Austin character being brought into this new text.
What my specialty area in Austin is texts that have spun off Austin. So I left those anxieties long ago. So it's always been in, because I was also working on published and unpublished work around Austin, and some of it is wild. Like, some, yeah, this is like, this is informed and respectful. Some of it is like just really wild. So we have like ultra religious takes. We have erotic takes. We just absolutely everything. So I didn't really have a sense that Austin needed to be protected from. Yes, it's a very. I'm very, very used to this kind of activity.
Well, that's my follow-up question. Would you consider doing it? Is it something now, as a novelist, you would think about? There's a lot of literary allusions in your book. Virginia Woolf is quite, present in your book, in the mind of your character, Layla.
I can't imagine doing it. It's a different thing for me. I feel, when I was writing this, I felt it wasn't out of my control, but it felt like it was its own thing and I was helping it become itself. So, basing it on using other pre-existing characters, I can't see it. I can't see that coming into my practice, but I suppose never say never when it comes to the human heart.
Okay. I wanted to ask you both about kind of point of view, because that's another thing that really interested me. So Kel and Sharmini use very much this Austen's free indirect discourse, which we talk about and write about and think about a lot. So we have a third person narrator, but there's some elements of the first person narration within this, because we can understand the feelings and the motivations of other people through this third person character. So, but it is Caroline's story very much, and I wondered whether you had ever thought about breaking that point of view and writing it in the first. Did you try it, Sharmini?
It wasn't me that tried it.
Oh, okay. Please tell.
No, we didn't try first. Yeah. Oh, actually, no, I think we did talk about it, but
yeah,
no, we wanted to stick with free and direct.
That's right,
because,
yeah,
you know, out of, you know, respect for Miss Austen. But I love a bit of head hopping. And for people who don't know, that's when you're in third person, so the narrator is, or it could be in any perspective, I suppose, but the narrator is, so it's quite close and you're reading it in third person, but you're reading it through the eyes, if you like, of one of the characters. And then suddenly you hop into somebody else's head in the scene, and so you see their point of view. I love that. And so I did it a few times with minor characters, because one of the things was, how are people seeing her? Like, she's blundering around London, this sort of working class areas that she's never been to, and she's just a fish out of water in lots of ways. And so I wanted to capture that idea of people looking at her and thinking, what is going on here? And Sharmini said to me, I don't know about that. I don't know that that's... And I'm like, oh, it's fabulous. Don't worry. It's working. It's beautiful. I love it. And the first thing the publisher said to us is, no head.
What was your instinct about it, Sharmini?
I think I probably felt like we needed more of it if we were going to do it. Okay. It was like these beautiful little insights into Georgiana or
Gordon.
Oh, don't
backpedal now.
I said it at the time. It's our first fight.
Yeah. Yoo-hoo! We've got witnesses.
That's right. I felt like, yeah, that it was enough of an unusual thing in the text that it kind of caught me up short. And I thought, if we put it in more or less. And then the publisher said, less, none.
I was allowed to use it slightly. But only for comic effect at the end of chapters.
Yes, it's definitely there to a degree. I noticed it. I think this would be a lovely point for you to read us a little bit of the book, and we can hear some of this.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is, so what happens is, Caroline Bingley is in Derbyshire at her brother's new estate, and she gets a letter from Georgiana Darcy, Mr. Darcy's younger sister, Georgiana's raced off to London, and so precipitously raced off, and so Caroline has to go find her and then takes her back to her new independent townhouse.
It's rather thrilling, don't you think, to be in town all by ourselves?
So she's an actor. This is what's going to happen. Okay. Georgiana smiled across the room at her. She looked very young, younger than her years, younger than the person who had contrived to deceive her brother and run away to London. And this is a really long sentence, I now realise. And Caroline suddenly felt the absurdity of the adventure in which she had tacitly conspired. Are you feeling any better? She asked.
Much.
Then shall we begin?
Only if you promise not to look so stern.
I shall promise nothing of the sort, Caroline said, until I understand what is going on. Georgiana startled as the door opened and two footmen carried in a tea tray. The conversation paused while Caroline poured, and one of the footmen stoked the fire. Georgiana sipped her tea, which Caroline had liberally fortified with sugar. But when she opened her mouth to speak, her bottom lip trembled. Caroline dismissed the footman with a wave and sat down beside her friend. Tell me exactly what happened.
I don't really know,
said Georgiana.
Oh, I have to do that. Will I do that bit? Okay. Oh, you've done it now.
All right.
I don't really know. The other day, Jade didn't come to wake me. They told me she'd gone, and I don't know where she went. No one does. The other servant said she'd run off, and my brother said he can't stop her if she doesn't want to work for us, and so I am the only hope she has in this world.
The teacup wobbled dangerously, and Georgiana put it down on a small table by her chair. Clasping her hands together, she crushed her handkerchief to her face.
I'm so worried for her.
It does you credit, I'm sure, that you are so concerned for the welfare of this girl, but I don't see why it should distress you so if she no longer wishes to remain at Pemberley.
But she wouldn't leave me,
cried Georgiana, tossing the handkerchief to the floor.
I miss her. I like to talk to her. She's always so sympathetic.
Caroline was wise enough not to argue the point. Did she say anything that made you think there was a reason for concern?
Yes, I told you.
Excuse me, but you did not. You only said that she had disappeared.
Did I not tell you about her brother?
Caroline stifled a sigh of impatience. Tell me now.
I'm sure I mentioned him. He works as a footman here in London, you know, and she's worried about him.
That does not seem to me to be overly distressing. Young men live to plague their sisters. You only have to look at mine.
Thank you. That was lovely. Kylie, I wanted to ask you about point of view as well. This is a very close first-person narration from our character, Layla. But I felt at times she was sharing, you know, her thoughts, her life with us at this particular period where her husband has just died, and he's been an enormous figure in her life. But I felt at times also you kind of wanted to protect the reader from judgment, really. I felt there was a kind of something quite delicate happening there. So you were showing her not just as a kind of focaliser of her life, but at times she's the witness of things and she doesn't particularly kind of comment on them or unravel them. She's a little kind of frozen in her witnessing. So the reader experiences them. I thought that was a very kind of sophisticated handling of that point of view. And also, of course, she's a novelist. This character is a novelist. So there's a sense that she's at times detaching into her imagination as well. So I'd love you to sort of talk about if you arrived at that naturally. And also, I'd love you to read too. Thank you.
Okay. Well, in terms of Layla being a novelist, it was very important to me that she be not only... She is a storyteller in general as well as the teller of this story. And you're right, Ken Black has died, her famous husband, and everyone thinks they know who he was. He was famous, their life was lived in the spotlight. They live in a house that had a glass frontage, which had a complete, I would say, illusion of transparency. Everyone, you could literally see into their house. But Layla knew what went on in that house, and she wanted to tell that story in her own voice. And so it was a very strong... marker for me that she'd be a novelist. And this is the perfect segue into the passage that I thought I'd read today. So thank you, Carrie, that was like perfectly done. So I thought I would read a passage, like as you can see, towards the end of the book. That I always in my mind call this the diving falling passage. It's the first time we see those words in that configuration in the novel, though there is a story behind them. And so Layla's gone to Sydney to escape the emotional carnage of what has gone on up until now. And she's working on her novel. And what was really important to me that Layla made a creative shift at this stage of the novel when she went to Sydney. So it's very interesting to know who she's having sex with and how, but it's also interesting to know that it was her style changed, her writing style changed. She had a creative shift when she was in Sydney. So here she is looking at the ocean. I went to Sydney, to the sea, and to my novel. It was coming quickly for me, faster than all the others before it. I had given myself a false deadline by telling my agent that I would have something for him soon, something new. Not like my other things, more mythical, more lyrical, a shift away from domestic realism. I wasn't quite sure what it would become, how it would become itself, but I knew that this writing, coming forth from a time of just being, only writing, not doing for anyone else, contained a version of the truth and that it was good. The muse had come knocking and a writer refuses her at her peril. I moved the desk to the window. Jasmine pulled from the old vine on the fence in a jar next to me. Its scent was too sweet, sometimes too sticky, and I would push it away to the other side. Outside, water, sky, and the weather really warming, making me shift my work to the far end of the table when I grew too hot, the pencil slipping in my fingers sometimes in my morning sweat. The year ending, another one, and my mind reaching for an ending or the illusion of one, of the beautiful object. Give me a few more days, another week, another fortnight, the weekend, I told Marion whenever she called to arrange a visit. This novel, writing this novel, shaping it, typing the last words, reshaping it, long days, revisiting it, coming home to it. It was Greek mythology, it was Roman, Celtic, there was wolf's sound of the sea all through it. It had taken me from the river to the ocean, to throw a scarf into its depths, its vastness, and not look back. Despite my long-held conviction that there are no endings and beginnings, only continuations, I was being drawn magnetically, helplessly, to creation myths, where goddesses give birth to land and sea, to stories of monsters of the deep, seafarers, sea caves, and dolphins calming the waters. My daytime concerns about rising sea levels giving way to larger, nocturnal fears that collected, swirling in my words like an eddying, dreams of drowning, diving, falling. Sometimes it felt like another death or a murder. Sometimes the thought of Sebastian reading those words and Vanessa and Lola gave me a swerve of panic, like vertigo, like standing on a cliff or a bridge or the rooftop garden of a tall, tall building, swaying. I frequently exhaled through my mouth as I wrote, a habit of mine that had always aggravated my sons, but I was in my own room now, no witnesses.
My own room is actually a good segue for me, because I wanted to talk about the physical locations of the books, the sort of houses of the books, because it seems they both spring from Wolf's Room of One's Own, but that's now been upscaled to a house of one's own. So Caroline Bingley, at what, 8 and 20, has her own townhouse, and you mysteriously say it's designed by a Viennese philosopher. So I want to know more about this, and also the research that you did around it. Would it have been very unusual?
You mean for a woman? It would have been unusual,
yeah.
Absolutely. But because she's not married, she has a lot more freedom than she would have if she weren't.
Mm.
And I think there's a sense in Pride and Prejudice that Darcy being at Pemberley is not just a kind of inspiration for Elizabeth to want to settle down with him, but for Bingley to want to settle down in his own place. And I think that sort of, we felt like pushed Caroline to want to have her own space. Mm. Not just a room of her own, but, you know, since she can afford it, a lot more than that.
Yeah. I felt the house was very, kind of represented a lot of her kind of independence of thought, and the place where she did a lot of this kind of, the physical work of her detecting, the writing out of her notes and all of that, the house seemed very important to her.
Yeah, well, if she's living with her brother, then Jane Bennett's the mistress of that house and would be expected to be deferred to about furnishing and about all of that, books and whatever else.
Mm.
Whereas if she's got her own space, she can do what she likes with it. She can make it comfortable in her way. She can have the books she wants there. She can have the rooms the temperature she likes them to be. She can have, you know, yeah.
And there's a line in Pride and Prejudice which is often misquoted, which is her sort of because she's one of the things in Pride and Prejudice is that she's just, she tries desperately to flirt with Mr. Darcy and she's really, really bad at it.
Mm.
And one of the things she says to try and impress him is, you know, I hope to have a library of my own. And when we talked about her and what would have happened to her at the end of Pride and Prejudice, we decided that she would have realised that the accomplishments that she talks about in that book were simply not enough. And so she wanted to create, she sort of re-educated herself. And one of the things that she did was read a lot. And she actually does take that throwaway line seriously. And she's read, you know, all the German philosophers and toured around Europe as best she can during the war. And so she's created this space. She has created a room of her own.
Mm.
And, I mean, the thing is that this was one of the first great generations of intellectual women. And we forget that sometimes. You know, you had incredible artists and writers and philosophers and musicians at this time, some of whom were highly educated, some of them were self-educated. And so in a way, she is part of this. And we're working on book two at the moment. And even though she makes a lot of jokes about lady novelists because she thinks that's a ridiculous thing for a lady to be. yes, true. She is in this generation where there was these incredible, like Austen, like Fanny Burney, like Madame de Stael, all these amazing women writing incredible things. And so we wanted to actually catapult her into that kind of world as well.
Thank you. I was fascinated by Layla's house, and like many people, I would walk and think, which house? Is this an actual house that she's talking about? So it is this sort of concrete and glass bunker. They live without curtains, which I would not be able to do personally. So that the family in the book are literally kind of on display as a kind of artwork. I thought you were sort of working with that. It made me think about Heidi on the Yarra. And it made me think about when I go into the cottage where they lived, I feel slightly uncomfortable because it's now a gallery, but it was also, of course, this intimate space where these people live their lives. So I was really interested in your thoughts around this house and this studio and how you created them. Like, is it based on somewhere that you know, or did you draw little plans? Or I had a sense of it being so concrete, the kind of movements between the studio and the house. And
I had a strong spatial sense of the house, but it's not based on any real house. It's, I suppose, an amalgam of houses I've walked past or read about or dreamed of or seen on television or in movies. So it's not a real house. It's Layla has two houses in the novel. And I say Layla has two houses, but in a way, I'd be interested to know your reading of this too. Like, the first house, the bunker, seems to be Ken's house, like a monument to Ken, to his aesthetics, to the way that he wants to be seen, the way, and you know, his great attachment to like the life of the eye and to the aesthetic life. It kind of resists Layla. One of the first times we see her, she's trying to, you know, the door is heavy as she's pushing it, and the surfaces of the walls kind of fight back. They're a bit scratchy, and then the second house in Avalon Beach, which during lockdown I went to Avalon, like during in between lockdowns, I went to Avalon Beach and had this just an amazingly creative and imaginative time there. So I thought I gave Layla a house there because she can afford it. So that house, I think, is much more the house of Layla's own. It's a world that she's made with her sister, and they may or may not be trying to do over their childhood. And so, yes, I see that idea of spaces that enable women and are comfortable for women that play out in like two different ways in the two houses.
Yeah, I definitely felt that. I was very pleased that she left the bunker behind and could see that she needed the new space. Although she didn't quite have the agency to say it was for her, and did say it was for her sister.
Yes. And then proceeded to spend most of the time there.
Inhabiting it. I think there's lots of lovely intricacies about family, about mothers and children. I think the kind of mother-sons relationships are really fascinating. Also, there's a marriage in the book and a new woman kind of coming into the family as well. So lots of very kind of delicate relationship dynamics that are really beautifully observed.
In terms of the mother and son dynamics, the title Diving Falling is a reference to a characterization Carl Jung made of James Joyce and his very troubled daughter Lucia, that they were two people going to the bottom of the river, one falling and the other diving. And that was a very strong visual image, part of the symbolic waterscape of the novel. And at first I thought it was, of course, Layla and Ken. But as I worked through the relationships with her sons, I thought it could also be Layla and her oldest son, Ken, Sebastian, or it could be Sebastian and his brother, Otis. So those figures were also changing for me in terms of those dynamics. So all those, as you say, family relationships all entwined.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating. I wanted to ask as well about, this is kind of following on from those relationships, but... it's your novel. It's a very embodied. She's a very embodied character. It's quite a sexual novel. There's just a lot of kind of intense physicality in the book. There's a lovely line. Layla sees someone in her front garden, and she says, "My body went unbidden into the alerted mode in which it had intermittently functioned when Ken was alive. My mind had almost forgotten, but not my body." I thought that was so telling. That's such a sort of telling line for the novel. So there's a lot of bodies in the novel. They're depicted in these paintings. They're depicted frozen in art. But our main character is a novelist. And, of course, language is not really frozen for a novelist. It's always kind of alive and can always be kind of re-entered on the page. So I thought you were doing some interesting things there between the kind of the visual and the written as well and the imagination. So really beautiful. And I wanted to ask... Kelly and Charmony, as we're talking about relationships and the heart. Caroline is very single and very singular in the book, and I know you have plans for her, but are any of the plans to do with her heart? Can you reveal?
This is an ongoing conversation. there are a lot of people out there who are shipping Caroline with her butler, Gordon, which was not our intention. But obviously we can't control what people want to do with that. So we're kind of chatting about that at the moment. Is that...?
Yeah, we don't know, basically. We're going to give her a few possibilities, but we don't know what she'll choose. But she can't possibly choose anybody of a lower social status than her, so people can ship Gordon all they like. Including our publisher. That's what our publisher thinks is going. We had our first meeting with the publisher and she said, "I love the sexual tension between Caroline and her butler." And we went, "Okay." We got off the call and went, "What? What have we done?"
Caroline's not queer.
Yeah, well,
she might be. She might be many things.
That's still occurred to me.
Me too.
It has occurred to us too.
Many directions.
There are many directions.
We will await that hungrily. I want to remind you all that you can buy copies of these beautiful books over here, Diving Falling by Kylie Mo Mohammadi and Caroline Bingley, Private Detective by Sharmini Kumar and Kelly Gardner. So thank you for coming along today. Please check out the La Trobe Literary Podcast and tell people about it. Tell them to subscribe and listen to it, please. I would like to thank Kylie Nichols from the library and her wonderful library team who put on Writers on Campus for us. Thank you. I would like to remind you all that the next Writers on Campus event will be held here in the library on the 27th of May. And I would like to thank Katie Holmes, Kylie Mo Mohammadi, Sharmini Kumar and Kelly Gardner. Thank you.
You've been listening to a La Trobe University podcast, produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri country. You can find out more about the launches at the library program on the La Trobe University website.